for once, Kim Jong-un is frightened by President Trump. I don't think he's been frightened or his father before him.
Talks and preparations continue for a Trump-Kim summit. It's Monday, May 28th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We invite you to join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China aims for the far side of the moon. Athletes turn refugees in Australia. Rolling thunder returns to Washington. Noise pollution pervades Karachi. And a Memorial Day story. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. officials are meeting with North Korean officials in Panmunjom to discuss a potential summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, according to the State Department. Spokesperson Heather Nauert said in a statement Sunday, preparations continue for a meeting between the president and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Trump announced Thursday he was withdrawing from the scheduled June 12th meeting in Singapore, only to say on Friday that the summit might be back on. On Saturday, he said conversations about a potential summit were going along very well. In North Korea, state media reported Saturday that it's North Korean leader Kim's fixed will that a summit with Trump in Singapore should go ahead. South Korean President Moon Jae-in met Saturday with Kim Jong-un near the two Koreas' heavily militarized border. The leaders exchanged views on how to prepare for the North's possible summit with Trump, according to the South Korean presidential office. After the meeting, South Korea's President Moon was upbeat. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Bruce Bennett, senior defense analyst at RAND Corporation Policy Think Tank, about his reaction to the ups and downs of the summit story so far.
Well, I think the expectation of the U.S. government was that it would all be ups, that Kim Jong-un had decided to take denuclearization seriously, and it was all going to proceed forward. But the history of working with North Korea is that they always like to get the last little ounce they can. They are serious about trying to get the details on their favor. And it's also not clear whether we've got some degree of misbehavior by North Koreans or what. I mean, they failed to show up for a meeting 2 weeks ago in Singapore with the American advance team. Hard to tell what was going on. Was this something Kim Jong-un was trying to marginally get some advantage out of? Or was this a case of people just not doing what he was telling them to? It's hard to tell.
Well, it is hard to tell, which of course must lead to speculation, which we don't always like to do, but sometimes we have to do it. And now the speculation is not only on what's happening in the White House as far as divisions within the White House are concerned, but also what do you have to say about the possibility of divisions in Panmunjom?
Well, I think certainly the potential for divisions within the North Korean government. I mean, Kim Jong-un has established control of the country based upon an extremely ruthless approach of killing a whole lot of people. There have to be a lot of his elites who really don't like him, and in particular don't like the idea of offering up their nuclear weapons as something that they're prepared to give up to get better treatment economically. So there could be some pushback, or this could be a strategy to move ahead. This could also be his charm offensive to try to take control of South Korea, because he said his New Year's Day address, which is the State of the Union address for North Korea, he talked about unification a dozen times in that address, and he didn't mean a South Korean-led unification. He meant unification under his control. So is he working towards that as well? We just don't know.
Do you think that Donald Trump has met his match as far as a deal maker with Kim Jong-un?
Oh, I think quite the opposite, actually. I think Kim Jong-un has finally met his match. The North Koreans are used to Americans giving in to a certain extent and not really putting up anything in the way of response to the North Korean misbehavior. That's not what's happened with President Trump. Back when President Trump did his UN address where he talked about Rocket Man, Kim Jong-un wrote a personal response 2 days later, and he said two amazing things. Number one, he said, I didn't anticipate President Trump was going to say this. Well, wait a minute. In North Korea, Kim Jong-un is supposed to be the god. How is it that he can be a god and be fallible, that he didn't understand it? And the second thing he said was, you know, it's a North Korean statement, a frightened dog barks louder. But the whole rest of his speech, or of his statement, is showing that he's barking louder, calling names and making threats. For once, Kim Jong-un is frightened by President Trump. I don't think he's been frightened, or his father before him, by previous American presidents.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Bruce Bennett, senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation policy think tank, via Skype. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. United States and North Korean officials discuss preparations for potential summit. South Korea urges North to salvage nuclear summit with U.S. Putin and Abe discuss Kuril Islands World War II treaty. Pakistan sets general election in July. Cat-proof fence creates a sanctuary in Australia. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia, as well as our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Now in space, after lifting off last week, China's new relay satellite is being tested as part of an unprecedented mission to land a spacecraft on the far side of the lunar surface later this year. The satellite will make possible communication between controllers on Earth and Chang'e 4's mission scheduled in December. Brian Harvey is a Dublin-based space writer, author, and broadcaster. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty this mission represents something entirely new for China's space program.
Up till now, China has focused primarily on reaching the same level of activity and technological development as the other space powers. And we have seen this in China's earlier lunar missions, in their first manned flights, and in building of a space station. But these are things that other countries have done before. No country has yet attempted a landing on the far side of the moon, and that is entirely new.
This is going to be a tricky maneuver, and there's no guarantee of success. How difficult is it?
It will be difficult. The Chinese seem to be fairly upbeat about it. China has had a very good record with its space missions. They have known very few failures, certainly compared to the United States and the Soviet Union in the early days of their space program. It is tricky. It is difficult. You're absolutely right. There is a possibility that this won't work. The launching yesterday was the first stage of a two spacecraft mission. The first spacecraft essentially is a small communications relay. It's about 485 kilograms. It will take 8 days to reach the moon, and it will then enter what's called a halo orbit, which is kind of describing a circle behind the moon so that it has the far side of the moon in continual view and is able to transmit to Earth at the same time. China has done a mission to this part of circumlunar space before, but the landing on the far side is, absolutely right, going to be the most critical, dangerous, and difficult part.
What is the significance of landing on the far side of the moon? What might scientists gather from that mission?
The far side of the moon is quite different from the near side. The lunar far side is almost entirely uplands. It's very rocky. It's quite possible, we don't know, it's quite possible that the rocks there, the surface there, are the oldest part of the moon, and we may learn new science that we have not yet learned from the near side.
Brian Harvey said 2018 is an ambitious year for China, which is expected to conduct no fewer than 40 rocket launches, surpassing both the United States and the old Soviet Union in launching the most satellites. Happening now in Asia, Pakistan will hold a general election July 25th as the government enters its final week in office. Pakistan's government and parliament is to be dissolved May 31st, when a new interim prime minister and interim administration is meant to take over. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're all starting out our week, and we're glad you're with us on VOA Asia. Some 200 people who have traveled to Australia for the Gold Coast Commonwealth Games have now applied for refugee visas, a sharp increase from previous estimates. Athletes from several nations, including members of some African national teams, disappeared from the Games Village in Queensland last month. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Refugee campaigners believe some of the 200 Commonwealth Games athletes and support staff who are seeking asylum don't want to go home because they fear they'll be persecuted because of their sexuality. Another 50 participants whose visas have expired have yet to contact Australian authorities, but would still be able to apply to stay. Officials won't confirm their nationalities, but reports say they're from Cameroon, Rwanda, Sierra Leone and Uganda. Sarah Dale is a solicitor from the Refugee Advice and Casework Service, which is acting on behalf of some of the asylum seekers.
We've heard lots of examples in the media recently, such as people who fear harm based on identifying as homosexual. In a number of Commonwealth countries, it is criminalised to be homosexual. So it's certainly our experience that we will see some people who are granted protection. But as for the overall figures, we're not going to know that until the end of processing.
Initially, it was thought only about a dozen people hadn't returned home when the games in Queensland State finished in the middle of April. The official number of athletes and staff has been disclosed at a parliamentary hearing in the Australian capital, Canberra. Australia's Department of Home Affairs said it would try to assess the applications as quickly as possible, but didn't specify how long the process would take. The assessment of some of the claims has already started. About 8,000 people arrived in Australia for the Commonwealth Games, an event held every 4 years that brings together members of a global grouping that emerged at the end of the British Empire. In 2006, after the Commonwealth Games in Melbourne, 45 people either overstayed their visas or claimed asylum in Australia. The government in Canberra is increasing its annual intake of refugees this year to 18,750 people. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, a thunderous roar born from the Vietnam War rolls through Washington. You're listening to VOA Asia. The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. This news from VOA Asia, Russian President Vladimir Putin and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe have met in Moscow for talks, including the dispute on the Kuril Islands. The Soviet Union took the four southern islands in the closing days of World War II. The dispute has kept the two countries from signing a peace treaty, formally ending World War II hostilities. You'll find this and more online at VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, it's Memorial Day weekend here in the United States, which for many marks the beginning of the summer season. Memorial Day is when the U.S. war dead are honored, and for more than three decades on the Sunday preceding Memorial Day, tens of thousands of motorcyclists have rumbled through the streets of downtown Washington.
The Vietnam War in the late 1960s and early 1970s was difficult for U.S. servicemen during and after the conflict. It was an unpopular war in the United States, and many questions have lingered about servicemen who were unaccounted and did not return home. The idea of a protest to address the issue was born in 1987 by Marine Corps Corporal Ray Manzo. In gathering support for his idea, he met Army Sergeant Artie Muller.
The more we investigated, the more we found out we just wanted to do something. We decided to do a demonstration down here, and the first 3 years we did a march and a run. And then after that, we decided we're just going to do the run. And it went from 21 to 2,500 motorcycles the first year to last year, they said we had over 500,000 motorcycles and some 900,000 plus people.
Estimates of Vietnam POWs and MIAs have varied. Personal issues forced Ray Manzo to drop out of Rolling Thunder's annual planning. But with later wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Mueller has kept the demonstration going.
We're here to demand the government do something about the lives they left behind. We're also here to support our troops that are serving now, to tell our government, if you want to direct our military and tie their hands, then they better put a uniform on themselves and tie their own hands and let somebody shoot at them. Don't put our military in harm's way and make them tie their hands.
The throngs of motorcycle riders come from all across the United States each May. Michael Edwards is the president of a Rolling Thunder chapter in Wisconsin.
It's about a 15-hour ride, 16-hour ride. They leave Green Bay, Milwaukee, Chicago, go to Buckeye Lake, Ohio, stay overnight, and then they arrive on Friday afternoon about 1 or 2 o'clock here in Washington, D.C. The total group, plus Rolling Thunder members, is probably 120, 130 bikes from Milwaukee.
And as a veteran, he says the issues pressed by Rolling Thunder remain very serious.
We took the same oath of office as these legislators did, and the same oath of office that the president took, to defend the Constitution of the United States. And we take it seriously. Even though some of us have been out of service for 40 years, we're still veterans.
Virtually every military veteran among the sea of motorcycles staged in the Pentagon parking lot in Virginia echoed the same sentiment about their ride into the nation's capital just across the Potomac River.
This is a First Amendment right. It's the freedom of speech, and we're not going to be silenced.
The Mullers say applications for permits to hold Rolling Thunder next year will be submitted on Tuesday, the day following Memorial Day.
This news from VOA Asia. A suicide bomber has detonated his explosive-laden mini truck near an army base in southern Afghanistan, killing at least 8 soldiers and wounding around a dozen more. The Taliban swiftly took responsibility for carrying out the bombing. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now in VOA Asia, smog, industrial waste, and contaminated water are just a few of the environmental problems facing many of the biggest cities around the world today. But there's another type of pollution that's becoming increasingly prevalent in our cities: noise pollution. Medical experts say people exposed to constant noise can suffer from a variety of psychological and physical ailments. As VOA's Bejan Hamard narrates for reporter Salim Cheyenne, it's an especially serious problem in megacities like Karachi in Pakistan, where noise is a constant companion.
When someone calls on me, I don't hear them. There's so much noise. I get really angry, but what can I do? I have to manage traffic, but there's a lot of noise here.
Like Constable Zubair, many of the city's residents are fed up with noise pollution. Most accept it as a fact of life in the city. But many are not aware that the constant barrage of noise may be harmful to their health. A recent survey shows noise pollution in Karachi is getting worse. Noise intensity is measured in units called decibels. Normal conversation is typically between 50 to 60 decibels, and the hum of the city traffic comes in at about 80 decibels. Experts say noise levels of up to 85 decibels may be irritating but are still considered safe. It's when it goes beyond that threshold that the human body starts to react. Noise levels above 100 decibels, about the same as the sound of a jet flying overhead, have been recorded recently in different parts of Karachi.
The main problem is obviously that it affects one's hearing, but aside from that, it can cause irritation, it can cause high blood pressure, to a point that it can lead to a heart attack.
In cities like Karachi, the main source of noise pollution is vehicular traffic. But industrial generators and factories play a big part as well.
The noise of traffic, bikes, generators, huge trucks. The ears after a while start hurting. Even when I go home, the noise is still buzzing in my ears.
If you must honk your horn, tap it. People here just place their hand on the horn and just not let it go. Truth is, this says that person has no feelings.
There are currently no laws to control noise pollution in Pakistan. While the issue of excessive noise has recently started gaining traction as an election issue in some municipalities, experts say don't hold your breath. For now, they say it's up to individuals to police themselves. Go easy on the car horn and wear earplugs. For Salim Shayan in Karachi, Pakistan, this is Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
We come back now to Memorial Day here in the United States, observed on the last Monday of May to honor the men and women who died while serving in the U.S. military. Originally known as Decoration Day, it began in the years following the U.S. Civil War, and it became an official federal holiday in 1971. Many Americans observe Memorial Day by visiting cemeteries or memorials, holding family gatherings and participating in parades, and unofficially it marks the beginning of the summer season. Today, we honor this day and the members of the military who gave their lives to this country with an episode from StoryCorps. It's a series of features based on people's experiences in their own words. Alan Ho was a combat medic in the Vietnam War. Continuing that legacy of service, both his sons joined the military. In January 2005, Alan's older son, First Lieutenant Naona K. Ho, was killed in action in Iraq. A few months later, Alan visited Washington, D.C. for Memorial Day ceremonies at the Vietnam Women's Memorial. And there he met Paula Coughlin, an Army nurse just back from Iraq.
I thought it would be great to welcome these young trauma nurses with some special Hawaiian lei. And I saw this Army nurse come walking up the path. And I said, here, this is a special gift from me to you. And she put her head down so I could put the lei over her shoulder. She noticed the button that I was wearing on my chest. And she just put her finger on it. And she said, I know him. I said, how do you know him? He was my son. And she said, I was the trauma nurse at the crash unit where he died. And she said, I will never forget that face. Both of us kind of looked at each other and we started crying and I gave her a big hug. But I could sense that something was bothering her. And I thought she may have sensed that my family might have been disappointed at the fact that our son, his life could not have been saved. And I said, I want you to know that my son was a warrior. He absolutely recognized all of the risks that were involved. She cried and she said that as the head trauma nurse, one of her tasks was to prepare his body for his men to have a last viewing. And she said that she tried to close his eyes, but as she went to press his lids together, they always would come open just a little bit. And she said that had bothered her all this time. And I looked at her and I laughed. And she kind of gave me this puzzled look. And she was like, I'm curious now, why are you laughing? And I said, my son would sleep with his eyes partially open. His men, when they were in combat, they were never certain what they could do when the lieutenant was sleeping, because they never knew if he was sleeping or he was just awake watching what they were doing. And I said, the simple fact that you shared that story with me totally convinces me now that you were with my son at the end. Now, I never have to wonder about those last final moments.
Our thanks to StoryCorps and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find our program online via iTunes and SoundCloud. You can download our program or you can listen to it on the radio. If you happen to be out and about somewhere in Asia, particularly Singapore, catch us on Radioactive at Temasek Polytechnic. Thanks to everyone there who tuned in today. And our thanks, As always, go to Director Tracy Carter, our engineer Zeynep Abdel-Rahman, Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.